Welcome, everybody. Thanks so much for coming out tonight. My name's Audrey Cooper. I'm a philanthropy advisor here at GiveWell, and we're so glad to be here. Also, thank you to Google for this amazing free space that they are letting us use tonight. So let's give them a little appreciation. So tonight, you know, there's a mixed crowd here. We have some folks who are longtime followers of our work, some new faces. So we're going to give you a brief overview of GiveWell's mission, our grant making, and then we've got two of our colleagues on the research team here, Elizabeth and Julie, who are going to be speaking about specific programs. Elizabeth's going to talk about our grant making to increase childhood vaccination, and Julie is going to speak about two partnerships that GiveWell has established to further aid our grant making to cost-effective programs. So lots of good stuff for you tonight in the presentation, and then we will open things up for a Q&A for the rest of the time that we have together. So please save your questions for the end, and then we will answer them then. Great. Okay, so just to start, I want to talk very briefly about GiveWell's mission and approach and some of the things that make us different. So GiveWell's mission, as you know, is to research and identify highly effective charities and then move money to them through our grant making. So our goal is to provide recommendations to donors who are kind of asking this question of, where should I give? What can I do to accomplish good in the world? And provide these recommendations about charities that save and improve lives the most per dollar spent. And I think the thing that makes GiveWell different from other charity evaluators is our focus on impact and cost effectiveness specifically as the model through which we approach our grant making. You know, impact is not always the primary goal of philanthropy. People have other goals as well, whether that is, you know, being a good citizen in their local neighborhood or prioritizing equal access to a good or service, regardless of what the cost might be, regardless of how hard it might be to reach a certain population because of a sense of equity or something like that. Now, obviously, funding equal access programs, funding programs in your neighborhood may be important, but because so few philanthropists kind of have this extremely narrow focus on impact, there is an opportunity for us to provide, you know, and donors like you to provide transformational support to high impact and neglected areas. So at GiveWell, you know, the way we approach finding those opportunities is by modeling the cost effectiveness of a given program to determine how much impact it can achieve. Really looking at the specific costs, benefits, second order effects, the impact of your funding on a specific program and what it can accomplish. And what we found over the years is that the most impactful and cost effective programs are really aimed at improving global health and poverty alleviation in low and low to middle income countries. That's where a lot of the gaps are for us to be able to make a difference. We don't try to rank kind of all the available giving options out there, but we try to really narrowly focus on those top opportunities where that are actionable, where we can direct funding and make a difference. So we fund a few dozen grantees each year, and we recommend a subset of those as outstanding programs called our top charities that you can kind of donate to on an ongoing basis where we think they'll be able to use your funding cost effectively. We really try to approach things by thinking at the margin and only funding a charity or only recommending it as a top charity if we believe additional funding will really allow it to expand and do additional good. It can't simply be a good program, but it needs to have gaps and opportunities to make more of a difference with additional funding. We also really try to consider the full picture of impact. So the counterfactual scenario of what would happen otherwise if we didn't give it funding? Would another actor step in and make that difference regardless of what we do? So we really try to get that full picture of impact. And so specifically, we offered kind of two main opportunities for donors to support our grant making. You can also, you know, fund a specific top charity if you want or give us money unrestricted, but these are kind of the two main methods through which donors partner with us in funding opportunities that we recommend. It's the Top Charities Fund and the All Grants Fund. This allows our researchers to then direct your donation to a highly impactful and vetted opportunity that kind of falls into one of these buckets. Both of these are great options depending on your preferences, but they do fund kind of slightly different profiles of opportunities. And so I'm going to give you just a brief overview of their differences, and then our researchers will speak about some specific opportunities that kind of are good examples from these funds. So the Top Charities Fund is allocated by our researchers to the highest priority opportunities at our top charities. What are our top charities? There are four organizations that we recommend that we are very confident in, we've maybe worked with for a long time, we put a lot of effort into our modeling, and they're kind of the short list of programs that are highly cost effective, can use additional funding well, and we're very, again, confident in our modeling. Those four organizations I'll just give you a brief overview. There are two that work in malaria control. So the Against Malaria Foundation, which provides bed nets to prevent the spread of malaria, and Malaria Consortium, which provides an anti-malarial medicine to prevent malaria as well. We also have an organization called Helen Keller International that provides vitamin A supplementation to treat vitamin A deficiency, which is a leading driver of child mortality. And we also have an organization called New Incentives, which provides conditional cash transfers to incentivize caregivers to bring their infants in to get their vaccinations. So in Nigeria, where they work, vaccination rates are low, and if you can incentivize caregivers to come in, it increases childhood vaccination rates, which then prevents deaths from those diseases. Each of those charities has funding gaps that we think are very cost effective, you know, where if you were to donate additional money, those funds would be able to kind of save additional lives through these programs. And so on an ongoing basis, our researchers are speaking with those organizations, assessing their needs, and then making grants out of the top charities fund to fill those gaps, kind of depending on what is highest priority at the moment. So for the All Grants Fund, this is more for donors who want to contribute to the full range of GiveWell's grant making, including organizations outside of our top charities list, and so maybe covering a wider variety of different program types or opportunities that are still, you know, cost effective and have a high expected value, high expected impact. So some of these grants, for example, might have the goal of incubating or scaling or learning more about a potential future top charity or, you know, potential future cost-effective grantee. We also fund grants that very directly like produce evidence about programs. So maybe we would fund a study to learn more about the evidence behind an intervention that we're less familiar with, you know, a randomized control trial, something like that. We also fund kind of maybe one-off opportunities. So maybe there's something that isn't a scalable program in the long term, but there is a very narrow gap to fill at the moment where we can kind of drop in and provide the funds to make a difference kind of on a one-off basis. Some of these opportunities can be higher risk, or they can be programs that are newer to us that we have worked with for, you know, maybe a shorter period of time than our top charities, so we're less confident in the modeling. But at the same time, we think this is a very, we're very excited about the grants that we make from the All Grants Fund because they do offer high expected impact and high expected value. So we use the same kind of cost effectiveness bar across all of our grant making. So a donation to either of these funds is directed to a grantee that will have a significant impact, but it just depends on kind of what types of programs you're interested in following along with and supporting. So I want to turn this over to Elizabeth to introduce herself and talk about a few grantees in the vaccination space that kind of fall into both of these categories.
All right, awesome. Thanks, Audrey. Hi, everyone. My name's Elizabeth Ironman. I'm a senior program associate at GiveWell, where I focus on grant making within our vaccines portfolio. So the vaccines team is one of three health area specific subteams within GiveWell's research team. So alongside malaria and then also our water and nutrition team. And so within this subteam for vaccines, we are particularly focused on vaccines that are recommended by the World Health Organization for infants to receive in their first year of life or so. So there is a handful of vaccines that are typically included, so that's the BCG vaccine, which protects against tuberculosis, the pentavalent vaccine, which protects against five different diseases, and then also vaccines which protect against pneumonia, rotavirus, and measles. So I wanted to talk a little bit about why we think vaccines are such a promising and cost-effective area to be supporting. And we've laid out really the key reasons on this slide. So to start, there was about 5 million under 5 deaths in 2021. About 80% of those were in sub-Saharan Africa and Southern Asia. So you can see on the map on the right really where those high rates of under 5 mortality are concentrated. It's been a global priority for many years to end preventable child deaths. So the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals set out targets that they're hoping to reach by 2030 in terms of reductions to under 5 mortality. But right now there's 54 countries that are off track to meet those targets. We also know, on top of that, that vaccine preventable deaths are a key contributor to under 5 mortality. So particular drivers of under 5 mortality include deaths due to pneumonia and diarrheal diseases. And those are two diseases that we estimate as making up the majority of vaccine-preventable deaths in countries such as Nigeria, which is one of the countries where we support vaccine programs. We also know that many infants aren't receiving any or all of the WHO recommended vaccines that I mentioned earlier. There was, I think last year, about 14 million children estimated to have not received any of the WHO recommended vaccines at all. And then there's also more children who are only receiving a subset of those vaccines. Two of the most important vaccines, we think, are those against pneumonia and rotavirus. And global coverage rates for those were only 60% and 50% in 2022. So a lot of children who aren't receiving that critical protection. And then the last thing to note is that vaccines are highly effective in protecting against disease. So they have been studied in very robust randomized controlled trials and range in efficacy anywhere from about 46% to 85%, depending on the vaccine. So given all of these things, it's really quite straightforward to directly model the impact that increasing vaccine uptake can have on lives saved. And that's why we're able to see these programs as being so cost effective. So we currently have three grantees within our infant vaccines portfolio. They all implement different types of programs which are seeking to increase the uptake of these vaccines. We also have considered grants related to malaria vaccines and vaccines for adolescents and adults, which sit kind of outside this portfolio, which is focused more on the routine infant vaccines. So first, wanted to give a little bit more context on where these programs are operating. So we're funding programs in Nigeria, Pakistan, and India. These countries had the highest numbers of under five deaths in the world in 2020, and they're also among the countries with the highest numbers of zero dose children. So when we're talking about increasing vaccine uptake, these are really some of kind of the most important places to be working, although there's many other countries that could use support as well. So the vaccine grantee that we've supported the longest and with the greatest amount of funding is New Incentives. So Audrey mentioned New Incentives. They're one of our top charities. We've donated over $100 million to them over the last several years, and they run a conditional cash transfer program in northern Nigeria. So caregivers bring their infants in to get vaccinated and then receive a small cash incentive. And that happens across six different visits to make sure that they can get all of the WHO recommended vaccines. For those of you who came to our event, our last event here in San Francisco, we had presented on a $30 million grant that we made last year to New Incentives, so you might remember hearing about that then. We also support IRD in Pakistan, so they run a mobile conditional cash transfer program in Sindh province. It's somewhat similar to the New Incentives program, but they're able to take advantage of high rates of mobile phone ownership in Pakistan to provide the incentives as mobile airtime top-ups rather than as cash, which makes the program a little bit more straightforward to deliver, a little bit less risk of fraud than when you're dealing with a program that's directly distributing cash. And then lastly, most recently, in March this year, we made a grant to Civita in India. So this is a relatively small grant compared to our other vaccines grantees, just $3 million in this initial grant. And that was supported through donations to the All Grants Fund, which is one of the opportunities that Audrey had mentioned. They send text message reminders to caregivers to remind them to bring their infants in for routine vaccines. They're doing that in two districts in Bihar state in India and 35 districts in Maharashtra state. And they're actually covering an area with over 130 million people. And so that's really possible due to the use of SMS as opposed to, you can see with New Incentives, for example, they're covering an area with a smaller population, but it's a much more intensive program. So the main thing I wanted to talk about today was really some of the key differences across these different programs and how different approaches can be cost effective in different settings. So I'm going to go through a table where I've pulled out really some of the key drivers of cost effectiveness. And you'll see that all of these metrics look quite different across the different programs. But all of these programs do end up meeting our 10x cash bar, which is what we're currently using for making our funding decisions. So the first one here is the under 5 mortality rate. So you can see that that's highest in northern Nigeria, where New Incentives is working. This example is for Katsina State specifically. And then there's a much lower rate among unvaccinated children in Maharashtra State, which is the Subida example. The next metric that we look at is what is the baseline vaccination rate. So when we look across all of those key childhood vaccines that I mentioned at the beginning, what is kind of the average vaccination rate across those vaccines, taking into account which of those vaccines are most important for averting mortality. And you can see, again, for New Incentives, where they're operating in northern Nigeria, the vaccination rate is extremely low. Whereas in Pakistan and India, it is quite a bit higher, although still not where ideally it would be. Then we also model, okay, what is going to be the increase in vaccination rates from the program? So you can see that for New Incentives, it's the highest at 18%, whereas for Subita, for these kind of like lighter touch programs, for SMS and ambassadors, it's much lower, 2 to 8%. And then when we look at cost, again, most expensive for the New Incentives program. That's like a very intensive, high-touch program. A lot cheaper when you're looking at just sending text message reminders. But yeah, as I mentioned, these all do clear our 10x bar. So yeah, we model New Incentives in Katsina State as 16x, IRD as 10x, and Subita as between 14 and 24x for the two different components of their program. And so maybe just to kind of like compare across here. So yeah, for New Incentives, when we look at it, has the highest mortality rate, lowest baseline coverage, highest increase in vaccination rate as a result of the program. And all of that means that it's still very cost effective despite having a very high cost per child. That cost per child is driven both by the fact that cash incentives are being given, so that's about $11 of the cost. And then also in order to deliver those cash incentives and make sure that they're reaching the right caregivers, New Incentives does have a very large staff working on the ground in northern Nigeria, going to all of the immunization sessions to provide those. When we look at a program like Subita, so it's operating in an area where the mortality rates are a lot lower, baseline vaccination is much higher, and we expect the program to have a lower impact on vaccination rates. But that still is also a very cost-effective model because the costs are so low. So really just wanted to provide these examples to kind of show how different models can work in different places. So then, yeah, you might be asking, you know, what's next for the vaccines portfolio now that we have kind of those three grants that we've made in the last year or so. So we are planning additional work moving forward to continue to build out the portfolio. One focus area will be on kind of continuing to do research on those existing interventions that we support. We want to resolve some lingering uncertainties around our cost effectiveness estimates for conditional cash transfers, text message reminders, and ambassador programs, particularly how much we think those each increase vaccination rates and how that might vary based on what the baseline vaccination rate is. And really there we'll be looking at what's the most recent evidence for these types of programs and, again, how does that vary based on the specific context that the program's operating in. We're also always looking for other models that could be effective for increasing vaccination uptake. One main way that we're doing that right now is through the CHAI incubator, which Julie will talk a little bit more about in a minute. And then we're also always trying to talk to folks in the field and just hear about other programs that could be promising and look into those. And then the last thing that we're planning to do is also consider whether there's opportunities that would be cost-effective to expand these interventions to other geographies. So as I mentioned, right now we're working in Nigeria, Pakistan, and India, but there are a lot of other countries out there that could really benefit from these types of programs. So starting to explore Kind of what is that short list of countries and what programs might be most promising there? So I'll pause there and we'll be answering any questions at the end, but I'll pass to Julie to talk more.
Hey everyone, my name is Julie Fowler. I'm a program officer and I'm going to be talking today about some work that's happening in our new area sub-team. This is where we're looking into potentially highly cost-effective investment opportunities that fall outside of the three health areas that Elizabeth just mentioned. So anything that's not water, nutrition, malaria, or vaccines sits in the new areas team. And today I'm going to talk about a couple partnerships that we're working on, which we've established with two organizations, Evidence Action and CHAI, the Clinton Health Access Initiative, to try to incubate and scale cost-effective programming. Quick sound check. Can you all hear me in the back? Wonderful. Thanks. So I'll go into more detail about these partnerships in just a minute, but first I wanted to discuss why they came to be and sort of the problem that they're solving for us. So as Audrey mentioned at the beginning, here at GiveWell, our whole reason to exist is to find highly cost-effective programs that we can recommend to donors to invest in. And one of the things that we're looking at to try to build those models is the evidence of effectiveness that each program or intervention has. Oftentimes, charities don't have really high-quality evidence for their programming, largely because donors don't often fund it. And so typically when we're starting to think about how to build out our understanding of a program, we start by thinking about the evidence that exists for it from the academic literature or from sort of, other potential sources. Once we have like a pretty solid understanding of the evidence, then we'll build out our model and think about whether this might be highly cost effective. At that point, we would, in a stylized way, try to look around and say, okay, what organizations are currently implementing this program that we think that we might be able to recommend funding to? And if they exist, great, we can recommend funding to them. However, there's a couple wrinkles that come into play in practice. One is that often we don't have really high-quality evidence that lets us answer all of our questions, but we think that a program might still potentially be promising. It's like, we just don't know the answer yet, so we need to find out. The second potential issue is that there might be a program that could be implemented, but an organization hasn't been able to scale it yet because nobody has funded it. And so in that instance, we might think, hey, this could be really great, but we need more evidence or we need an organization that can actually do it. And so that's the kind of like problem that our two partnerships with CHAI and Evidence Action is trying to solve. All right, so I'll talk about each of those in turn. You might be surprised. Okay, so Evidence Action is an organization that we've worked and continue to work with. We have funded it. Well, Evidence Action is a parent organization of Deworm the World, which GiveWell has funded since 2011. And we made a grant to them beginning in July of 2018 to fund them directly to work with us to identify and scale potentially cost-effective programming. Their process on the accelerator mirrors the process that my team and I do at GiveWell on the first sort of steps, where they're starting by doing screening to see what kind of programs exist that there's evidence for. They're moving, if something looks potentially promising, going a little bit deeper, and then if it still looks good, moving into a deep dive. Where our processes diverge a bit more and where it's really valuable to have an implementing organization as a partner comes around stage four, where they'll do in-country work to scope and design potential programs, and then in stages five and six, launch a program and eventually potentially test it at scale. Through the accelerator, we've made the decision to fund several grants outside of it, and a couple of those have to deal with, or a couple of those attempt to address an issue of water quality. So what's the problem? Over 2 billion people, estimates suggest, in the world don't have access to safe water. Kids often get diarrhea from unsafe water, which can lead to death for young children in particular from dehydration, but it also exposure to the kind of pathogens that are in unsafe water make them susceptible to other diseases. The one estimate from the Global Burden of Disease Project suggests that 15% of roughly 15% of under five deaths in sub-Saharan Africa are due to diarrhea, and we think that, in fact, because of those interaction effects that I just mentioned, where like you can become more likely to die from causes outside of diarrhea because of exposure to unsafe water, we think that 15% might be an underestimate. All right, and the thing is that we know how to treat water. This is a problem that we know how to solve. But our understanding is that historically, many big donors have been focused on water access rather than water quality. So this is, you know, piped access, getting people the kind of infrastructure that lets them easily get access to water, but not being that concerned about what kind of water comes out of a tap. So through the accelerator, we have eventually made the decision to scale two different approaches to solving this water quality issue. One of those is dispensers for safe water, which is shockingly a dispenser that's located at access points where people go to collect water. You just turn a dial, it dispenses chlorine into your water, your jerry can or whatever it is that you're carrying the water in, and then by the time that you're home, the water is safe to treat. A separate way to solve the same problem is with a device called inline chlorination, which has the benefit of being automatic. People don't have to do anything. You just get safe water, like you or I do, out of the tap. The downside of it is that you need a piped water access point, so that there needs to be a way that the device is attached to a pipe. Okay, so with our support, Evidence Action has launched inline chlorination in Malawi. And we hope through the grant that we just funded there to not only begin to treat water and get people that access to the safe water that I just mentioned, but also to address some of the key uncertainties that we still have, such as how many people use the water point. Okay. how many people use the water points that are treated by the inline chlorination? What's the baseline quality of water of those users? All of these quantities actually make a big difference to our bottom line cost effectiveness, and we think by working with Evidence Action, an organization that we have this close relationship with, we can continue to collect data that will let our understanding of the program and its ultimate cost effectiveness grow over time. Example two. With the Clinton Health Access Initiative, we recently made a grant to fund the incubator. It would be too easy to call them both accelerators, so they need their own names. And the process that we're funding there is quite similar to the one that we're funding with Evidence Action. I think one difference is that CHAI has country offices across many countries across the globe. And so we're hopeful that once we identify potentially promising programs with CHAI, we'll be able to fund them at scale and achieve high impact that way. I'm not going to go through the stage by stage, because it really is quite similar. but I wanted to talk about one of the investigations that's currently in process. So we've talked a bit about malaria, one of the main causes of child mortality throughout Africa. ACTs are one of the most effective ways of treating malaria. But access to ACTs, which are these quality assured treatments that are highly effective, remain unfortunately low across many contexts. So with CHAI, CHAI is right now, through the incubator grant, doing a small-scale pilot in one state in Nigeria, looking into whether subsidizing ACTs, these highly effective treatments, in private pharmacies can increase uptake among the people who need it. I think this is a great example of a program that is useful to do through this close partnership, because we have a lot of uncertainties about it. One of the key ones is whether, who are the people who will be induced to be treated through these private pharmacies, and specifically whether very young children, who are the people who disproportionately die from malaria, will end up getting access to treatment. So we're eagerly awaiting pilot results from Kaduna State in Nigeria, and if it turns out that this program is effective at causing children to be treated, then we might go on to recommend funding for it. All right, So I think that these types of partnerships are extremely valuable for us. They provide a well-defined path for testing and then potentially scaling promising and cost-effective ideas. I think that it helps us in terms of implementing interventions that we don't have organizations to implement for. It helps us in terms of continuing to collect the monitoring and evaluation or other data that will let us get a more, hopefully more accurate and richer understanding of the program over time. And just a plug that the Chai Incubator is relatively new, and we're excited to see what comes next. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Julie. Okay, so before we close, we also want to share about some of the work we do that is sometimes behind the scenes and not specific to a single grant investigation. And the researcher who is going to talk about that today is sick and not able to be with us, so I'm going to do it. So in addition to, researching programs in order to make grants, we also do research and work to improve our research itself. And we kind of call this cross-cutting work. The goal is simply to improve the quality of our research and our grant making at the end of the day, to ensure that there is consistency across the different investigations on different parts of the research team, to ensure that we are getting feedback and evaluating our own work to find areas of improvement, and to address, high priority key questions that don't fall squarely into the box of being addressed in a single grant investigation. So there's three examples here of the types of work this might represent. So the first is trying to be clear and consistent across the team. So we're trying to develop guidance to make our cost-effectiveness models clear and standardized across programs. So for example, if we are incorporating an effect in that model for a certain type of program, and it actually applies to another program as well. So for example, how long do the benefits of a given program last? We want to be doing that consistently across a program in vaccination and a program in malaria or different types of areas, as you might be able to imagine. The second area is ensuring feedback loops. We really value, transparency, feedback, improving our work here at GiveWell. And so we want to get strong feedback loops, both internally and externally, finding ways that we might be wrong about how we're approaching our work. An example of this kind of project is something called the Change Our Minds contest. We ran a contest earlier this year with cash prizes where we invited external stakeholders, basically anyone who wanted to submit critiques of our work and specifically where we might be getting things wrong in our cost effectiveness models, where the modeling might be leading us to make grants that we shouldn't be making. And so we got a lot of great responses and are thinking through how to implement some of the feedback that we received now. And that kind of falls in this cross-cutting bucket. And then finally, an example of a high priority research question that we want to be sure we're addressing is how should we model the value of information? So sometimes we think through the impact of a grant where the main goal is to learn more about a program rather than to directly fund something that is saving and improving lives. We want to learn more about an area or an intervention rather than just supporting it to scale up very directly. So how do we model the value of those learnings, which might change how we allocate funding in the future? That's a really important question from our research, but might not fall squarely into a single grant investigation. If a program looks more or less cost-effective, if we were to fund a randomized control trial, fund a study of it, and then we direct more or less funding to it moving forward, how important is that? Should we make that grant as compared to making a grant to expand vaccine access, and kind of like how do we compare those things and their relative importance? That's a really important question for how we allocate funding and resources, and is something we're kind of addressing through this work. Since we're moving so much funding to impactful giving opportunities, we really also value improving the quality of our research, making sure that it is consistent and legible, and always looking for ways that we can improve. So that's a bit of an overview there. And we're gonna now just open it up for Q&A. So if you have any questions, we can just jump into those. I don't know if you guys wanna drag the chairs over. I'm happy to stand, but maybe just move yours over. Cool. Okay, we've got a question here on the right.
You mentioned impact. What's the time span of which you measure the impact? Because a lot of complex systems take a long time for it to flourish, or there's tipping point involved. So how do you take that into account in your research?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so the question was, when you talk about impact, what's the time scale that you're modeling it over? And I would say that in general, we're talking about impact in the pretty near term. The longest benefits that we tend to model are for children who receive health interventions as children and then perhaps go on to have higher income as adults because of their improved development during early childhood that's caused by not experiencing, say, severe malaria or malnutrition as a child. So yes, that's our typical practice. I think to your broader question of, are we sure we are right about that practice? Might we be missing perhaps longer term kind of changes, either at a societal level or at an individual level? I think it's an open question. It's definitely not out of the realm of possibility that we would start to try to understand those things. I think up to this point, our decision has been mainly driven by practicality. It's been about, like, where do we have evidence and sort of what is the range of uncertainty that we might be opening our models up to if we start to try to think about, I don't know, the Industrial Revolution or something like on the 400-year time scale. But I think it's not, what I want to say is that's been our current practice, but it's definitely not a sort of cut and dry decision.
Sorry, the follow-up was like, do you track your grantors past your granting period for that reason?
So the question is about the organizations that we're funding or about
participants? The grantees, Do you track their impact beyond your granting period?
As far as I'm aware, we have not done any tracking that looks at a period after GiveWell funding ends.
Thank you all so much for the very informative presentations. I was hoping you could just expand a little bit on, this might be a naive question, but in some ways it feels like it's a part of the whole thing, but there was this slide that talked about cost-effectiveness with multipliers, cash multipliers, and I have to admit I didn't quite understand what that was saying, so...
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you for the question. So the question is, there was a reference to evaluating our grants in terms of multiples of cash transfers. What does that mean? How does it work? So we're in our models. We're trying to come to a bottom line number of like the impact or how important a given grant is. And we fund a lot of different types of grants that do a lot of different things. Some grants save lives, some improve childhood development, some avert disease, right? And so we convert all of those different outcomes into a single metric that we compare to the value of simply giving unconditional cash transfers to people in poverty. And the reasoning here is it allows us to kind of make comparisons between a lot of different things in a single metric. And I think in principle, if we're not doing something better and something more leveraged than simply giving money to people who need it, why are we doing this work, right? And so, in each of our models, we are making a comparison to the value of unconditional cash transfers and trying to find things that are at least 10 times as effective in our model as unconditional cash transfers. That specific bar, that specific number of 10x, is somewhat arbitrary. It's basically allowing us just to match how much money we think we have available to fund the most cost-effective things and work our way down the list. And so we're aiming to fund everything that we find that is at least 10x as cost-effective, and that's kind of roughly aligned with how much money we expect to have available. But that bar can't change. It's just an arbitrary working bar.
Follow-up question to that, but like, what are the metrics for that comparison? So, like, how do you compare vaccination to cash transfer?
Yes. Okay. So the question is, how do you compare very different kinds of programs to cash? And so the answer for that is, we use a system of quantitative weights that we call moral weights to put kind of numerical values on the relative importance of different types of outcomes. So we could say saving lives is really important. And so is improving childhood development, and so is averting some kind of disability. And we use quantitative weights to make those comparisons. There are, sets of weights. This is not uncommon in global development, right? There are some weights that compare the severity of different diseases, things like that. We've kind of created a model using different inputs, using staff inputs, just years of life that are averted, or years of, years of life lived with a disability that are averted, expected years of life that you would get if you averted a death, things like that, as well as a study that we funded into the preferences of beneficiaries, so low-income people in low-income countries and what they might prioritize, relatively speaking. So all that to say, it's gone into this quantitative model of moral weights, which you can look at on our website, understand more, and then that allows us to basically multiply the outcome of saving lives by its relative importance and then get that bottom line number. And those metrics, I don't think, represent like some principled truth about how important those things are at an existential level that we're very confident in, but it allows GiveWell to make resource allocation decisions and compare between different grants with our limited resources.
It sounds like all the top charities are life-saving programs. What's your best guess as to how many dollars it takes to save them?
Yeah, so the question is, all the top charities save lives. What's the best guess to how many dollars it takes to save a life? The answer to that is it really depends on the charity, both on our top charities and other grantees outside the top charities list. And it really depends on the very specific location. Like even I think in Elizabeth's example, you saw, you know, example states where there's very different costs, very different mortality rates, but roughly, I think in the $5,000 range, but we have funded grants in the last year that were $2,000 to save a life or an estimated, you know, $12,000 to save a life. So it really can vary.
So y'all have done cool estimates of impact, and then you get to see how they actually turn out. Any cool observations on like how that comparison that helped you grow as a forecaster of impact?
Okay, so the question was, our models are in fact predictions saying if we allocate this money, we expect this to lead to this many lives saved. And have we looked back and found like actual examples of that impact? And I would say that in terms of systematic measurements, we have not tended to look at mortality. And that's partially because, thankfully, even in very high burden contexts, mortality is relatively rare and quite difficult to measure. So most of our sort of like monitoring from grantees tends to be on things like uptake of the intervention, like so like when we think that bed nets are being delivered, we fund coverage surveys to find out if people in fact say that they have the bed net. And so that's sort of where most of our the monitoring that we fund has been focused.
I know that in the past, sometimes you've had challenges identifying enough high-impact opportunities to use all the funding that's available to you. Are you currently funding constrained, or?
Yeah, great question. Okay, so the question is, in the past, there have been times where GiveWell has said there is more funding than giving opportunities available. Is that still the case? No, it's not. So we are definitely funding constrained. Basically, last year, there was a period of time in which we said, you know, our research team is looking at a lot of early stage new interventions, they're investigating a lot of new opportunities, our research team is growing, and at the very moment, like, if you were to donate, we would hold on to that money for some period of time until those investigations came to fruition. We are well past that point. Last year, we raised about $600 million and had $900 million of cost-effective opportunities that we were ready to recommend to donors. That continues to be the case, I think. Yeah, it was more a function of scaling and the timing of investigations rather than some representation that in the world there isn't a need for more funds to be directed to do good and save lives and lift people out of poverty. Yeah, does that answer the question?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, so I'm still curious about this issue of impact and the moral weights.
Yeah.
So can you elaborate more on who gets involved in the process of kind of calibrating those weights?
And sure.
The public is involved. I know you mentioned some kind of study where people were able to question that. And then I have a related question to that. So has GiveWell done any analysis on the impact on like animal welfare, like the scalability and applying the same metrics to charities in that area?
Yeah. Sure. So two questions here. I'm going to answer the second one first. So you asked, has GiveWell thought about animal welfare, maybe the relative importance of addressing that compared to other outcomes? We are not focused on animal welfare. I would say that's more of a tactical decision than a commentary on the relative importance of that. There are other organizations in the space that we know very well, such as Open Philanthropy, which is a foundation we're very closely affiliated with, that does work on animal welfare. They're doing a great job. I think there's maybe a organizational strategic advantage there rather than GiveWell getting into it. So no, we're not currently doing work in that space. For your first question, which was about moral weights and how we gather inputs on those values, so you can read kind of the full write-up of this on our website, but basically we did a project a couple of years ago to come up with these weights. They are not extremely precise, right? This is a tool that we're using for resource allocation and grant making. And it needs to fill that function, but I think there's a lot more work we can do. I think we are uncertain on whether we've gotten the right values, and there's obviously more values that we could incorporate here. But very literally, our moral weights are comprised of inputs from staff who we think have deeply considered these issues and are thinking about, you know, global stand or like, yeah, other approaches to this and their own personal views, as well as a survey from donors so that we can get a sense of what people expect when they engage with GiveWell's product, and also a survey that we funded, which was a study of about 2,000 people in Kenya and Uganda and their preferences on kind of, yeah, that thought experiment of which of these outcomes would you prioritize if you had limited resources and you could save X number of lives, or you could, you know, double the incomes of households in your community with that same amount of money, which one would you choose? And then we've kind of weighted and incorporated those things into the model. Sorry, Ghana, not Uganda. Excuse me. Thanks. Yes.
Piggybacking on that then, is there a process where every X number of years you kind of reiterate your process on this model to see if there are any updates to it, and if so, what is that time?
Yeah, so there's not a set schedule for this kind of thing. I do think minor updates wouldn't dramatically change the course of GiveWell's grant making. So to give you the literal numbers, the moral weight for averting the life of like a child under five, averting the death of a child under five is like in the 100 to 110. That's the number. And then doubling the consumption of a household for a year is a value of one. And so
one
you,
person, not a household.
Thank you. One person is one. And so you would say, if I have $1 million and I could, you know, save one life, that's obviously the wrong number, but or I could double the incomes of, you know, 100 people for a year, those things would kind of be equivalent in their prioritization and their importance for GiveWell. And so you can imagine maybe someone might disagree with that. Someone might say, I actually think, you know, improving livelihoods is more important than that. But in order for it to change kind of our grant-making decisions, you would have to have a pretty significant update. And so I think minor changes aren't going to have a super dramatic effect on the types of programs that we fund. Yeah.
Yeah, so as of the last time that I checked, which was a number of months ago, GiveWell publishes room for more funding estimates for different charities that it funds. And I've noticed that it publishes these estimates pre-GiveWell rather than post-GiveWell. I'm curious if you could comment on that. You know, obviously, it's sort of a pretty different numbers, pre-GiveWell and post-GiveWell, where for the donors, the post-GiveWell funding, you know, feels more relevant, and where obviously for GiveWell it feels like the pre-GiveWell number. I'm curious if you could comment on that,
yeah,
on that question.
I can say something if you want to talk about your incentives at all, maybe. Okay, so the question is about GiveWell says, kind of publishes estimates of what we call room for more funding, or like kind of how much more additional dollars could this charity absorb and be able to put to use productively, you know, to accomplish their goals. And some of those estimates are kind of this like, yeah, static number, but where does your donation fall into that? Is that before or after GiveWell made a grant, and kind of how does that fit? So I think GiveWell is looking for funding opportunities, and then we are trying to direct money to those gaps and fill them to the extent that they are cost effective. So that is how we are working. And so I don't know that those static numbers for our top charities really represent the way that we're working or thinking about things in that sense. When we, and that's really only for our top charities, that's really where those numbers are published. So for our other grantees, right, we find an opportunity at Suvita to expand childhood vaccination access, and we assess what the room for more funding is, and then we fill it with our grant. And so I think the information for our top charities, again, we are in the same way, trying to direct donor dollars to the extent that that is full. So if someone wants to choose Against Malaria Foundation and make a donation to them, that's great, that money will go directly to them. And then when it comes time for us to kind of consider the next grant-making opportunity to them, we would then incorporate how much funds they have on hand from those donations that you may have made when we're assessing how much additional funding they need, and then we try to fill it with our grant-making. So I think it doesn't really matter whether you look at it before or after. We're trying to, at GiveWell, get a full picture of their needs and then use the funding we have available to fill that to the extent it is cost-effective. Does that make sense? Cool. Do you want to say anything about incentives? Okay, cool.
You said something about like a contest to prove you wrong.
Yeah.
Sounds like a cool idea. I'm curious like who won that, how you win that, and what kind of ideas were brought up that you thought were good.
Yeah. Andrew, would you be willing?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Good round of applause.
Hi, everyone. I'm Andrew. So, last year I did some work on the Change Our Mind contest. So I think it was maybe around like 50 entries that we had in this contest. So I like read and assessed all of those. One of the questions was like, how do we choose these winners, and maybe like what kinds of people submitted these critiques? I think that there were kind of like a pretty wide variety of different types of people who submitted critiques. We had some professors, like economists. We had some like health economists who kind of do some modeling that's somewhat similar to GiveWell. Some people who are interested in effective altruism, global health, and development that submitted critiques. A few from implementing organizations as well. When we were looking at those, we were thinking about the clarity of argumentation, how likely it is to change our mind, and how likely it was to affect the grant allocations that we would make. So at the very top, we had two winners. One critiqued GiveWell's approach to quantifying uncertainty. It's like quite technical, I think. We are still in the process of responding to that critique, but we are thinking very hard about it. Another one did an in-depth critique of our water quality cost-effectiveness analysis, which we were just talking about. They also had like a few in-depth critiques that we are also still thinking about responding to. But those are two examples.
Thanks, Andrew.
So adding to that, or following up on the uncertainty topic, I was curious as to how you evaluate the moral weight of present people versus future people, if there's some kind of discount factor applied to kind of evaluate that, and how that would work.
Do you want to? Thank you.
All right, I'm back for this one. Okay. This is actually something else that came up in the Change Our Mind contest that criticized GiveWell's approach to discount rates. Very basic idea for a discount rate is something like, if somebody were to give you $100 now or $100 a year from now, there are like a set of reasons why you prefer to have $100 now. Part of it would be related to uncertainty about the future. Part of it would be related to, like, you could take that money and invest it and then have more than $100 a year from now. In sort of cost-benefit analyses and cost-effectiveness analyses, some of the sort of standard practice is to apply some of those discount rates at a social level. What GiveWell does is that we apply a 4% discount rate for future increases in consumption. This comes up with programs that we think may improve, childhood programs that may result in increases in income later in life. We apply this discount rate to them. It's kind of like a big complicated topic. One part of it is like this, maybe like a more philosophical part about whether you inherently value people more, not just because of uncertainty, closer to the present than the future, and our stance on that is that we have like a zero weight on this pure time preference for people now versus in the future. So the things that we're discounting for are more related to uncertainty. Let me know if that makes sense.
Thanks, Andrew.
Do you want to just keep it, Andrew?
All right, maybe one or two more questions. So let me go in the back.
So the question was about measuring impact. Some are harder to measure, some are maybe easier to measure, so what's something that we're optimistic about being able to measure? For new incentives, we are really excited to be able to measure the impact of the program in terms of the increase that we see in vaccination coverage rates. What new incentives does is once they start operating in a certain area, they will start conducting household surveys to understand vaccination rates. So they'll do the survey before they start working there to understand what's the vaccination rate before the program. And then a year into the program, they'll do another survey. And then every 6 months thereafter, they'll do additional surveys. So we'll be able to see very directly how vaccination rates are changing in that specific area as a result of the program. We'll have to consider, are there other factors that are potentially also influencing vaccination rates at the same time? And they are doing also maybe some surveys in control areas as well to see generally, not the same area, but in Nigeria, how are vaccination rates trending? So we'll have a very good understanding of how the program is impacting vaccination rates. And because that can be tied so closely to mortality, we should be able to be quite confident then in roughly the number of lives being saved as a result of the program.
All right, last question, maybe if there's someone who hasn't asked one yet. No takers. Okay, here, yeah.
So last year when you all did this, there was a lot of talk of sort of the state of malaria, and there was some conversation around what the outlook on the malaria vaccine that was being talked about then was, and you all had given some sort of a sneak peek on what your evaluation of that was going to look like. Is there an update on that? Are you all thinking about malaria vaccination now?
Yes, so we published. The question was, last year at this event, we talked about the malaria vaccines and we gave a sneak peek. And what's going on with those now? And my answer is, we published an intervention report with our take on the currently approved malaria vaccines. And in broad strokes, it's what I mentioned last year. We think that they're an effective tool in the toolkit. We don't think that they're a panacea, but we think in certain contexts they may be able to be, there may be cost-effective giving opportunities to help fund, to help speed up the implementation of the existing malaria vaccines. We also recently recommended a grant to fund a study looking at the co-administration of malaria vaccines with some of the anti-malarial medicines that we fund regularly to help prevent malaria among small children. So there's evidence that combining these treatments is more impactful than either treatment alone in seasonal settings. Our study would look at, in settings in which malaria is concentrated in the rainy season, our study would look at perennial settings, which are those where there's high malaria transmission year-round, and trying to understand how the combined impact of these two treatments looks compared to either treatment alone.
All right, well, thank you so much for being here, for asking questions.